Est-ce que, si je pourrais bien résumer, est-ce que la position mosaïque n'a pas été en même temps une position de survie politique? C'est comme ça que vous avez posé votre question à la base. Et comment, au moment où de l'émancipation, s'est posé le problème de l'intégration des Juifs dans cette position particulière qui était la leur, d'être à la fois, je veux dire, d'avoir une position à la fois religieuse et politique.
Parfait. Bravo. It's a very interesting question. The argument that the survival of the Jews shows the superiority of Moses as a lawgiver is actually not an argument that these guys want to make. And the reason for that is that the Christian world had a very established argument about why the Jews have survived. Right? It's providence. God keeps the Jews, going back to Augustine, right? God keeps the Jews to serve as a witness to the truth of the gospel through their sufferings, right? Their punishment for the denial of Christ. So the important thing that we have to remember about these people, about these early modern Hebraists, is they, first of all, many of them did not admire Jews at all. They were, for the most part, not Philo-Semites of any kind. Most of them would begin their texts on the subject. Even their, these Hebraists writing works of translation, grammar, they would say, look, we're very sorry that we have to introduce these, these Jewish texts. But they're sort of all we have. If you want to understand the political constitution of the Hebrew Bible, the rabbis are witnesses to it, and otherwise we couldn't understand it. We wish we could rely on other sources rather than these, but we take what we can get, and so we hold our noses and we read. That's usually the attitude. Now, there are some exceptions to this. By the time you get to the sort of the middle of the 17th century, you get some genuinely Philo-Semitic writers who actually revere the rabbis, very interestingly. Probably the most important and famous of them is John Selden in England. He's a great jurisprudential and antiquarian theorist. But they don't like Jews. They don't think the Hebrew Republic has continued into the modern day. They think the Hebrew Republic ended. They disagree slightly about when it ended. But certainly, they think it had effectively ended long before the destruction of the Second Temple, and they distinguish very sharply the Israelite constitution, or what they called the Hebrew constitution, from the Jews, right? The Hebrews as opposed to Jews. So the idea what Judaism is a kind of continued adherence to the laws of the Hebrew Republic, has to wait a while. Mendelssohn makes that argument, of course, but then you're in the 1780s. It's much, much later. These writers don't want to explain the survival of the Jews as a function of their continuing adherence to the laws of the Hebrew Republic. They want to explain the continuing existence of the Jews as an effect of God's providence, and their deserved punishment, right? So I think it's different. But you're quite right. By the time you get, by the time you get to the middle of the 18th century, it becomes a very common argument. You find it in Rousseau. You find it in Mendelssohn, lots of 19th century writers. People like Tolstoy. Lots of people end up making that argument. But not these guys. They're not. They're not doing this for important theological reasons. Yeah.
Well, just Spinoza, of course, rejects that because he says the reason that Jews survive is just anti-Semitism.
Yes. And circumcision. Circumcision, but he has, you know, there's the famous passage in Spinoza where he says that, you know, one day God may yet, you know, if they remain, if they keep their practices, God may yet elect them again, you know. Even Spinoza is more complicated, but yeah, it's not an argument. They want to draw a very sharp distinction between the biblical law and rabbinic law. Rabbinic law, they think, is for the most part, a bodlerization of the biblical law, is a falsification of it, is a corruption of it. So, for the most part, they don't like rabbinic Judaism. I mean, there are, as I say, there are interesting exceptions. I could talk about that more if people are interested. But if you wanted the big takeaway is that these people were not fans of rabbinic literature. They were using rabbinic literature because they thought it was heuristically necessary to, in order to understand the biblical text, and that's it. Yeah.
Autre question, Monsieur.
Robert Abenaïm.
Very interested in particular the second point, because I'm working on the question of Shemitah, Yovel, and redistribution, and I wasn't aware at all that this has been a question pointed by Christian thinkers. And so what's strange is how do we go from there to the 18th century, where you have all the big declaration, for instance, Declaration of Independence of United States and the Bill of Rights and the first declaration of human rights in the French Revolution, when on one side they do make reference to God, Creator, Être Suprême, on one side, and on the other side you have sacred rights of property. The property is then a sacred right. So how do you go from here to there?
There's a lot to say about that, so I have to discipline myself because I go on. Two points, and this is not exhaustive, just two to consider. One is that, in a way, it goes back to what I was saying just now, that the 18th century, this approach, this genre, really comes to, not an end, because there continue to be contributions, but the high water mark of this genre is sort of the end of the 17th century. And that's not by accident, because it's also, by the 18th century, the religious landscape is very different. The view of scripture, as I said, is very different. And the idea that the Hebrew Republic is a model that ought to be followed in modern politics is much more controversial. I don't say there aren't people who continue to make the case, because there are. And this brings me to my second point. In the case of the United States, in the case of the American founding, one of the things that I tried to show, in particularly in my first book, is that this way of arguing, this understanding, actually is very powerfully present in the founding generation in America, because they've been reading Harrington, right, and the other sort of disciples of Harrington. So it's extremely common for Americans to argue, yes, private property is sacred. I mean, the right to hold property is sacred, but the necessity of equalizing it is or preventing extremes is of fundamental importance. So they all say, rather strangely in some ways, that one of the great facts about America is that there's rough equality of holdings. We don't have super rich, super poor in the 18th century. Now, as I say, this is slightly bizarre, but they, particularly in some states. But, I mean, compared to Europe, it was not stupid. But it's something that Americans said about themselves. Particularly as you get into the imperial crisis and you get the rise of this idea of an American character or an American nation, they say we're a people, we share a religion, we share a language. Now, both of these are bizarre because there were many languages spoken in the American colonies and there were many, very different, many, many different religious denominations. But the kind of story that by the time you get to the 1770s and 80s, Americans told themselves about themselves was what unites us is a common language, common religion, and equal conditions. And we have to maintain them. And this was taken very, very seriously. I mean, it's not widely remembered, even in the United States, it seems to me, that when you think of someone like Thomas Jefferson, you know, when he wrote his autobiography at the end of his life, he sort of paused to identify what he took to be his greatest political accomplishment, the sort of great triumph of his political life. And you might think the Declaration of Independence or being ambassador to France, or you might think it was being president of the United States, or the Louisiana Purchase, or you might have a long list of what you thought was going to be Jefferson's greatest political accomplishment from the point of view of Jefferson. Jefferson says, my greatest political accomplishment was in 1776. I got through the Virginia legislature the abolition of primogeniture and entail. Right? That's to say, the inheritance laws, the introduction of inheritance laws that would prevent accumulation of estates in families. And he took the two great, just following this tradition, he took the two great enemies to be primogeniture, the right of single son, first eldest sons to inherit, and the practice of entail. Comment dit-on cela en français? Entail. Entail? C'est la même? Okay. Yeah.
Il y a d'autres questions. Chaque.
Merci beaucoup pour cette excellente présentation, très intéressante. Et je vais poser ma question en français, mais je peux parler en anglais si besoin est après. C'est pas tellement une question. J'aimerais bien savoir ce que vous pensez de quelque chose de la différence entre Hobbes et Spinoza que vous avez exposé ici et là, parce que après tout, on s'interroge sur ce qu'est la modernité politique ou l'origine de la modernité politique. Et en s'interrogeant là-dessus, on s'interroge aussi, en tout cas pour les contractualistes, sur ce qui était peut-être le ferment du lien social, ce qui allait maintenir le lien social précisément dans la paix, puisqu'on essayait d'échapper aux guerres civiles, etc. Et chacun réfléchit à sa manière sur ce lien social. Donc ce qui est intéressant, c'est de savoir comment est-ce que l'imaginaire ou l'idée de la République des Hébreux pouvait informer sur la nature de ce lien social. Alors, ce qui est très intéressant, c'est que chez Hobbes, évidemment, la Torah, le lien social juif, c'est un paradigme, vous l'avez dit, c'est un idéal, c'est une inspiration, mais ça appartient au passé. Mais c'est le paradigme presque le plus important, on a le sentiment de ça dans le Léviathan. Mais ça appartient au passé, et jamais il ne parle d'une renaissance de la politique juive. Tandis que chez Spinoza, c'est l'inverse. C'est-à-dire que, comme vous l'avez dit, il y a une espèce de diminution de la loi juive chez lui, puisque les écritures ne sont pas divines. Donc il y a une dévalorisation. Et en même temps, chez Spinoza, il y a l'idée qu'il y a une persévérance des juifs et qu'il y a une possible renaissance de la politique juive. Donc, en fait, on a il y a un effet de miroir ou d'inversion entre Hobbes et Spinoza. Et pourtant, les deux cherchent la nature du lien social pour le fameux contrat qui pourra maintenir la paix civile. Un paradigme pour l'un sans la possibilité de renaissance de la politique juive, absence de paradigme pour l'autre avec la possibilité d'une politique juive. Qu'est-ce que vous pensez de cette opposition? Parce que Spinoza a raison sur le fait qu'il y a une renaissance de la politique juive. Mais Hobbes a raison sur les fondements du contrat, je crois, sur les fondements du contrat social dans la législation de la modernité politique. Bon. Il doit y avoir un juste milieu entre les deux, peut-être, sur cette nature du lien social et ce que la République des Hébreux dit sur ce lien social.
It would be quite right to say that Hobbes denies the possibility of a revival of Jewish politics. I would say he's silent on this subject, if you see what I mean. I don't think he takes a position. It's certainly not, I mean, you're perfectly right, it's not important to him in any way that there should be a sort of continuation of the Jewish people and a revival of a Jewish state by Jews. But I don't think he has anything invested in denying that either. So I think it's maybe not, you know, it's something on which he's uncommitted. Now, what is true is that it's, you know, I mean, the fascinating thing about Hobbes, and maybe this is what you were thinking of, is that as those of you who have read Leviathan will know, he spends about that many pages. It's a long, you know, the first two parts of the book, which are long, talking about laying out his idea of the covenant, right? And what he calls sovereignty by institution. And this is the whole familiar argument of the we all alienate our wills to the sovereign, and then he becomes our representative, and then in virtue of being represented, we become a people, and this whole story. But very interestingly, very importantly, there is another way of instituting sovereignty, which he calls conquest. Not by institution, but by conquest. And then it turns out, oh, by the way, that every single state in the history of man is in the second category, except one, right? The Hebrew Republic. Right? The only government by institution is what he calls the kingdom of God, right? The terrestrial kingdom of God. So it's not just, as it were, his example. Or, you know, it's not just a kind of exemplary of his idea of covenant. It's the only example. Right? He is fully aware that that this is not how states begin. So he has a whole story, which I don't need to get into, about how it is that conquest can serve the same function as institution, because ultimately will, you know, if someone is in a position to offer you protection, you then owe obedience as a matter of natural law. And so once I accept the rule of my conqueror, he becomes my representative. But this all happens tacitly, right? But it's very, very interesting that actually the only example in human history, he thinks, of a Hobbesian covenant, properly speaking, is this. So, in a way, I just by saying that your point goes even further than you yourself were suggesting. It's massively important. And he has this idea that there will again be one more commonwealth by institution, which will be the recreation of God's kingdom when Christ returns. And this will be instituted through baptism, through willing baptism. And then God's kingdom will be restored. And the radical thing he claims is that's just what the kingdom of God means. Right? The kingdom of God is not an otherworldly kingdom. It's not something in heaven. It's not something that's metaphysical or spiritual. It's a historical moment, a historical commonwealth that will be reinstituted at some future moment in sacred history. So Spinoza doesn't think any of that. But it's a fascinating question. Fascinating.
David, je veux bien que cette réponse soit, si on peut la traduire, résumer un petit peu en français. En attendant, vous pouvez manger.
La réponse de Michel Nelson. Donc, vous voulez que je résume tout ce qu'il vient de dire.
Oh, la pauvre.
Vous me demandez des choses difficiles.
Oh, je suis désolé.
Mais je vais essayer de me rappeler depuis le début, mais c'est vraiment très. J'écoute passionnément, donc j'y suis bien pour vous. Maintenant, il faut que je retourne en arrière. Il s'agit donc de la position de Hobbes par rapport à celle de Spinoza, qui lui parle de deux sortes de d'obéissance institutionnelle, d'un côté...
Souveraineté de... la création de la République.
Soit par l'institution, soit par la conquête, c'est-à-dire l'obéissance volontaire aux conquérants. Mais, donc, M. Nelson pense qu'il y a chez Hobbes la croyance que tout de même... À un certain moment donné, la République des Hébreux, c'est-à-dire que la République idéale, par le don de la loi sacrée, dans un avenir ultime qui est celui du protestantisme, en quelque sorte, c'est ça que j'ai compris comme déduction, devrait arriver, ce qui est absolument opposé à la position spinoziste où il n'y a aucune intervention, aucune croyance du sacré.
Oui, parfait.
Non, c'est pas parfait.
Il y a d'autres questions.
Moi j'en ai une.
Allez-y.
À la seule fin de faciliter le travail de ma voisine, ma question va être ultra courte.
C'est très gentil.
Est-ce que vous pourriez définir république ?
C'est court, mais c'est pas facile.
C'est un cours de philo.
A couple of things to say. This is, by the time you get to the 17th century, this is a highly contested term. That is, people are arguing about what it means, which itself is a new reality. That's to say, in the 15th century, no one really argued about the term république because it had a very stable definition. République was, res publica, right, in Latin. Commonwealth in English, république en français. All the same word. Was understood to be, to mean any legitimate constitution. It was, for instance, never understood to exclude monarchy. So a monarchy could absolutely be a republic. And here they were following the practice of their Latin sources, their Roman sources. The Roman writers do not, I mean, we talk so easily about the Roman Republic as opposed to the Empire, the Roman Empire, right? Or the Principate, or whatever we mean. We mark this break. In 31 BCE, when Augustus becomes the first emperor, They don't. The Roman writers, even the most anti-Caesarist Roman writers, talk about Res Publica Romana all the way through. Right? It's always the Roman Republic. So when Rome, when it's a legitimate constitution, a lawful government that aims at the public good, it's a Res Publica. So you can have a monarchical republic, you could have, and indeed, the most famous book, just to give an example, the most famous, probably, work of political theory written in England in the 16th century by a guy called Thomas Smith. It's a study of the English constitution, is called De Republica Anglorum, on the Republic of the English, right? But of course, England is a monarchy. But there was no problem, okay. This begins to change as early as the 15th century when the humanists first translate Aristotle into humanist Latin. Because the first translations of Aristotle in the 13th century were scholastic. And the way you would translate if you were a scholastic is when you got to a Greek term, you would just write it in Roman letters. You wouldn't even try to translate it if it were a technical term. So when you see in the first translations of Aristotle, you see the word demokratia, they just write demokratia in Latin, right? Or aristokratia, oligarchia, whatever. Also, politia, right? So they say politia, you know, politeia, constitution. Or politeia, as Aristotle uses it, that means the correct form of the rule of the many. They just write politia, right? They don't translate it, they transliterate it. When the humanists come along, they hate this because they think it's terrible Latin. You can't write Latin that way. You can't use barbaric, you know, sort of barbaric Greek terms. You have to find a proper Latin term, ideally one that was used by Cicero. And so beginning in the 15th century, when Leonardo Bruni translates Aristotle's Politics into Latin for the first time as a humanist, when he has to translate, what do we call Aristotle's constitution that is the virtuous form of the rule of the many? Res Publica. Now we have Res Publica as opposed to aristocracy and monarchy, right? As its own kind of constitution. And that sets in motion a rival tradition of people who understand republic as a non-monarchical constitution. You know, if you have a prince, you're not a republic. And maybe the most famous example, just to show you that by the time, already the beginning of the 16th century, this is already firmly established, Machiavelli in The Prince. Right at the beginning, he says there are two kinds of states, only two kinds of stato, right? Principalities and republics. Right? They're mutually exclusive. However, the other tradition, the tradition of thinking you can have that monarchy and republic are not opposites, they're not antonyms, it continues. And people use the term this way even into the 19th century. So the answer to your question is that there's no answer to your question. It's a contested term. People are fighting over it. It's a crucial, because the monarchists, the people who live under princes, don't want to surrender the term. It's very rare. There are examples of this. So, by the time you get to the 17th century, monarchists are willing to let the term go, some of them. So Charles I, for instance, when he writes his famous response to Parliament, he says, you're attempting to make of our kingdom a republic. Right. Well, that what he's saying is, you're taking away all my power so that you would no longer properly have a king, and that's what a republic is. Right. So he's using the term in the new sense. But many, many people continue to use it in the original sense. And that, as I say, that continues. You know, when you have the debate over the Constitution of the United States, John Adams, who is, you know, one of the most important figures, second president of the United States, one of the, you know, the leading revolutionaries, When he's asked what kind of government is the United States, as established by the Constitution, he says it's a limited monarchy. But it's still a republic, because it's a monarchical republic, as he says. He actually uses the term. He says it's a monarchical republic. You could have a popular republic, you could have an aristocratic republic, or you could have a monarchical republic. Right. So it's not until really the middle of the 19th century, and even not even universally then, that the modern sense of republic that means, you know, you don't have a king. You know, when Australia says, you know, when the protesters in London during the coronation were saying, we want a republic now, right? What they mean is no monarch, right? If we have even a monarch who has no power, we're not a republic, right? That's the new view. Yeah. Does that helpful? Did you do that? Yeah. Okay.
Rosy.
Je peux poser une question de traductrice.
Certainement.
Je n'ai pas exactement compris à quel moment, quand les humanistes traduisent au lieu de transcrire, hein, res publica, qu'ils traduisent quoi?
Ah, they're translating the term politeia. So in Aristotle, right? Aristotle, it's a very confusing fact about Aristotle. The term politeia in Greek means, I mean, it's actually a very complicated term, but for our purposes, let's say it means constitution in general. Any kind of constitution is a politeia. And there are different kinds of politeia, right? Monarchy, aristocracy, something else. Aristotle uses it in the term politeia in the generic sense, right? But he also uses the term politeia in a specific sense, because he calls one particular form of government, that is to say, the good version of the rule of many.
Mm.
Right? The equivalent, when we're talking about the rule of the many, of monarchy and aristocracy, the good version, he calls it politeia. Just constitutional government, you might say. He calls it constitutional government. So the question is, how do you translate this word? Because there is no good Latin translation for this word. So, for instance, the most famous example is Plato's Republic, the dialogue La République, mm-hmm. right, de Platon. It's not the title, right? That's Cicero's title, right? It's Politeia. And Republic is a very problematic translation of Politeia, because Politeia is much broader. But Bruni uses the term Res Publica there to translate politeia in the special sense. And that then gives him the ability, because he's a Florentine, to say, actually, we're the only ones who have a republic. You know, the Milanese up north with their signori, they don't have a res publica, right? Now, the Milanese called themselves a res publica. I said, of course we're a res publica. We're a res publica with a prince. But they're but in the war that they're fighting in the early 15th century, that becomes ideological, right? Florence is saying, look, we the popular state here with no prince, we're the only true republic. And Aristotle says so, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Alors je rebondis sur ce que vous venez de dire, sur ce que vous faites allusion aux petites républiques italiennes. Et on a vu que les auteurs de la tradition juive, ici dans ce séminaire, n'étaient pas du tout insensibles au modèle que pouvaient constituer les républiques, justement, ou les États, ou les dans lesquels ils vivaient. On l'a vu pour Abravanel, qui fait l'éloge des petites républiques italiennes, en disant que c'est le meilleur des régimes, ou en tout cas peut-être le moins pire. Bon, lui-même avait l'expérience de la monarchie espagnole. Donc, on l'a vu pour Flavius Joseph, qui prend au fond le modèle de la politeia grecque pour relire ce qu'il appelle les antiquités juives. On l'a vu encore avec Joseph Salvador, sur lequel a travaillé Vincent Peillon, qui est peut-être le dernier avatar de ce que vous avez décrit au XIXe siècle. Alors, j'aimerais savoir si vous voyez une sorte de backlash de cette élaboration conceptuelle des hébraïstes chrétiens autour de la République des Hébreux dans la pensée juive moderne. Ah, c'est peut-être une colle.
Non, bravo. Non. C'est très important. And the answer is yes. You mentioned Abravanel, and that's an early example, very early, amazing, right? That in the discussion of monarchy, right? In his comment on Devarim, right? He actually says when he's talking. Look, if you know, and it's the structure of the argument is kind of kol v'chomer, right? Mm-hmm. So if look how great Rome and Florence and Venice were. As republics without kings, even greater, you know, even less need do we have for a king because God is our king, right? So, but the idea of using the examples of these European states and ancient Rome and bringing it in to the actual rabbinic discussion is a watershed. It's a remarkable moment, and the answer is it never stops. What the Hebraists are doing. Becomes very important to the way that crucial Jewish writers are thinking about these questions. And the example that I wish I had talked about more in the book, but I had to stop somewhere, so I wrote an article, is Mendelssohn. So Mendelssohn, again, you know, I think that Jerusalem, his text of 1783, is very often misunderstood in all kinds of ways, but one of the things that is absolutely clear, you can show this clearly, is that Mendelssohn, in developing the argument that he makes in Jerusalem, which is essentially, of course, that there should be no binding religious law, right, of any kind. His argument, and that the rabbinic law should be followed, right, I mean, Jews should continue to follow it, there he separates from Spinoza, right? Mm-hmm. We should continue to follow it, but as he says, in foro interno, right? It's a matter of conscience. It's not something that can be coerced because the Hebrew Republic no longer exists. And all of these laws were civil laws, and he's not only citing Hobbes and Spinoza, which he does, for his argument, but the entire argument about what the Hebrew Republic actually did in relation to religious law, and you know the argument that actually even the Hebrew Republic didn't make lots of religious laws. It didn't use the coercive power of the state very often in religious matters. It didn't publish. It didn't punish. He thinks blasphemy in all kinds of instances. It didn't punish. It didn't force people to conform to. The Mosaic religion, he's using John Selden. And he's using Selden's technical vocabulary about the Noahide laws and natural law. And he has on his shelf, we know, he owned a copy of the Selden's De Jure, which is where he makes this argument about the argument about the mitzvot b'nei Noach and that the ger toshav, all of that stuff that we were talking about comes into Selden, and then Selden takes the next step, which is quite amazing, and says that actually the mitzvot b'nei Noach are natural law. That's what natural law is. It's these the laws that the rabbis elaborate, and of course, how amazing is it? You know, these are not in the Bible, right? I mean, that's to say, it's an elaboration. His list of them he takes directly from the Talmud. I mean, it's not in the Torah. So he says, not only does he go along with what these earlier writers had said, he goes a step further. He says, this is what natural law is, and Mendelssohn follows him. So Mendelssohn is actually using Selden as a rabbinic authority, which is amazing. So the answer is yes. This comes back into Judaism. And the Erastian idea that fundamentally the only time you make religious law is for the sake of civil peace, and that means very, very minimal religious law. And that explains why there were some religious laws in the Hebrew Republic, why you couldn't, for instance... what someone like, and he's just following Hobbes and Spinoza, they all say, well, look, so, okay, you say that the Hebrew Bible is in favor of toleration. Okay, what about all the laws that seem to be religious? What about the prohibition on blasphemy? Well, Selden, following these earlier writers, and then Mendelssohn just picks it up, says, well, actually, the number of... first of all, they defined blasphemy very narrowly. And even then, the only reason it was criminalized was because this was the one state in human history in which God was the civil sovereign. So blasphemy in that state, but in only that state, is sedition. In the same way that idolatry in that state, but only in that state, is treason. Right? Because if you bow down to another god, you're betraying the civil sovereign. Right? Mendelssohn just takes all of this.
Ben c'est une réponse. J'imagine qu'elle pourrait être encore de tous ceux qui ont suivi Mendelssohn. Qui pourrait montrer combien même la tradition juive a pu être enrichie par cela. Est-ce qu'il y a d'autres questions ? Oui ?
Maintenant que j'ai écouté les spécialistes,
Eva Tanger.
Je voudrais dire mon plaisir de lire. Parce que, absolument, vous avez. C'est un travail d'une grande érudition, à travers plusieurs langues, et qui fait la jonction entre l'Occident et l'Orient, entre l'Antiquité et les temps modernes. Et j'ai lu ça comme un roman policier, parce que c'est dit avec une clarté. Si vous voulez vous restaurer la grande fresque historique et le débat politique depuis l'Antiquité jusqu'à aujourd'hui, en somme, avec une clarté extraordinaire. Pour quelqu'un qui n'est pas érudit, c'est vraiment absolument passionnant. Et donc, je voulais vous remercier pour ça. La deuxième chose que je voulais vous... Alors, les observations que je me suis faites en vous lisant, c'est qu'évidemment, une chose évidente, c'est le rôle de la communauté et des protestants est fondamental dans cette restauration du modèle biblique. Et non, alors ça, c'est la première chose, évidemment, qui est frappante, mais la seconde chose, c'est que, par ricochet, il y a le rôle de la langue hébraïque et des hébraïsants. Et donc, s'il y a des hébraïsants, il y a forcément des rabbins, enfin, vous les citez d'ailleurs, et donc c'est très intéressant de voir, parce qu'on n'en parle généralement pas du tout, justement, ça revient à la question un peu de Nicolas, cette osmose, mais discrète, si vous voulez, et même, comment dire, secrète, entre des érudits protestants par rapport à la langue hébraïque et des érudits juifs. Et donc, pour revenir, si vous voulez, au thème qui nous anime dans ce séminaire, ça donne à la diaspora, si vous voulez, juive, un rôle tout à fait essentiel dans cette diffusion, si vous voulez, et cette restauration et ce questionnement du modèle biblique.
First of all, thank you. One of the things that, in a way, because one of the things that I should also make clear is that there are actually surprisingly few Jews in the story of Hebrew diffusion in the early period. Remember, in many of these places, there aren't any. So, for instance, England, right, which is a major center for this genre of writing, had expelled its Jews in 1290. That they were not readmitted until, I mean, the myth, you know, it's kind of the 1650s as a very beginning. And by the way, this was one of the arguments made in Parliament about the readmission of the Jews. They have to help us learn Hebrew. This will be good for letters, for scholarship. But first of all, some very few of these places had Jews. And the ones, and it was very dangerous. I mean, when, you know, one of the, there was a sort of a Jewish scholar who was brought over to England in the 16th century in the very beginning, kind of turn into the 17th century. To teach Hebrew to these Hebraists who wanted to learn. And he was required to convert, and he was imprisoned and would have been executed if these great eminent scholars hadn't petitioned the king directly to release him. So in general, the Jews who were doing the teaching in the places where there were Jews, like in some places in Holland and various other European territories, were almost always converted Jews. So these were Christians who had begun life as Jews and knew Hebrew. It was still very controversial to take instruction from a Jew in most of these places. And even in places like Holland, where it was somewhat normal, I mean, one could do it, there were all kinds of taboos associated with it and all kinds of controversies that developed. So, again, it's a very interesting sort of story, because on the one hand, Jews played some role in Hebrew instruction, but this was a project that was very often carried on entirely without contact with Jews. And the result of this was they made a lot of mistakes. Just to give you an example, because I thought it was funny, maybe this is a good way to end, because it's where I began. I was talking, remember, at the very beginning about Milton and the passage from Devarim Rabbah. So I see that he's quoting it verbatim, but he never talks about Devarim Rabbah. He never talks about the Midrash. He never says, I'm getting this from the Midrash. And then you read the source he got it from. And the source he got it from has this entire passage translated word for word in Latin, and then has the Hebrew correct, word for word, but never says Midrash. And what the text says, so you say, well, where am I getting this? He says, I'm getting this from Bar Nachman. And I'm looking at it, I think, who's Bar Nachman? And I was thinking, and I see they're all talking about this. The ones that are using the Midrash, including, by the way, Grotius, says, as Bar Nachman says, and then he'll quote something that is actually the Midrash. And I didn't understand what was going on until I figured out that they looked at the name, the Midrash Rabbah, and they thought this meant it was the Midrash by Rabbah. And they needed to find a Rabbah. So they found there was a Rabbah Bar Nachmani. It's a Tana in the Talmud. And so they think he's the author of the text. And so they identify the text as Bar Nachman. For 100 years, no one is saying... So this is obviously a discussion that doesn't involve Jews, right? Because, no one is saying, I see what you've done, let me fix this for you. So they go for a very, very long time. And they make other mistakes. Selden, who had very good Hebrew, corrected a lot of them. He also did know some Jews and also was very admiring of the rabbis. So, for instance, some of them were very important, and this is where I'll close because I could go on for a while. But remember, I was talking about the debates about blasphemy. So this was very important because there was a question about whether the Noahide laws, as systematized in the Talmud, license toleration or not. And some Christian Hebraists argued, I don't know what the tolerationists are talking about, because one of the Noahide laws is a mitzvah al birkat Hashem. They think, so not understanding that it's a euphemism, because they don't want to write curse, right? They think this means that there's a positive obligation to bless God, which they think means there's a positive obligation to attend worship, meaning you must go to church, right? So toleration does not extend to people who don't want to attend church. And it says so right there, because there's a Noahide commandment to bless God. Selden has to come along and say, no. In rabbinic literature, they write your cut because they don't want to write, you know. And so they're making a lot of these important mistakes where a lot depends on this, right? So if you think the whole question of whether you can compel citizens to attend religious services depends on how to translate birkat, you know, in that phrase, it's very important. And in some ways, it's very admirable how far they got without Jewish teachers for the most part. But it's also, they make a lot of mistakes. Yeah.
Mais il me reste. Il y a encore une question.
Encore une question d'actualité. Comme nous avons la chance de vous avoir comme spécialiste des grandes périodes sur justement ces rapports et ces liens entre les communautés, comment vous voyez la révolution qui se passe en Israël, c'est-à-dire ce changement dans le débat politique actuel en Israël, comment vous le voyez de votre point de vue?
Oh gosh. Maybe I'll answer that one once I've had some vodka. I don't think. Yeah. Yeah.
Mais oui.
Yeah.
Vous nous avez de toute façon donné des outils pour penser le contemporain à partir de la première modernité. Et on ne saurait que trop vous en remercier. Et aussi parce que ça rejoint notre souci de montrer non seulement ce que les Juifs peuvent tirer du monde dans lequel ils vivent, mais aussi ce qu'ils peuvent lui apporter, et lui montrer qu'ils ont apporté quand même beaucoup plus qu'on ne pensait. Donc merci beaucoup.
Merci.